we gather together as your body to around your word, we pray that you would feed us, that you would show us the glory of your great name, the glory of who you are, and help us to be faithful followers of our Savior. We pray in his name. Amen. All right, well, we are tonight moving into a new book. We pushed back. You saw the email probably about mission trip report's going to be next week. They needed another week, so we're going to hear about the South Africa mission trip next week. We're actually to the book of Daniel in our flow. If you remember, what we're trying to do is we're going chronologically through the Old Testament. And so we covered Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, Samuel, Kings, and then we went into the prophets, because the prophets are writing contemporaneously with 1 and 2 Kings, particularly 2 Kings. And so we have worked through the pre-exilic prophets, starting back with Hosea and Jonah, and then working all the way down to right before the exile with Jeremiah, and then into the exile with Ezekiel. And then we looked at Obadiah, who writes shortly after the exile. And then we did Lamentations the last few weeks. And today we're moving to Daniel. Daniel kind of bridges. He is considered in some ways an exilic prophet. Now, what's that mean? Exilic means he wrote during the exile. Okay, the exile is basically 605 or 6 to 536 B.C. It's a 70-year period of time that begins with the first incursion of the Babylonians into Judea, in which they take captive a number of people. Daniel was one of these. Daniel and his three friends are among that first group that are taken captive. So they're exiled from the land. And so the exile, the clock starts ticking then. It ends, and really you have the people arriving back in the land about 536 B.C., 70 years after they left. The first group under Zerubbabel get back to the land. Daniel is called an exilic prophet, but in some ways I think it's better to think of him as a post-exilic prophet. Now, why is that? It's because there's a difference between the events you record and the time you actually write. Now, I want you to listen carefully to what I'm talking about. One of the important things of interpreting the Bible is to think about the original audience. Okay? And so when we ask the question of when Daniel wrote, one of the things you want to think about is, well, we said, you know, when we introduce a book, we talk about the author, we talk about the date. The Bible doesn't tell us explicitly, Daniel doesn't begin by saying, I, Daniel, wrote this, or the word of the Lord came to Daniel, but it's clear he's the author. I mean, he's describing it, you know, from the first person vantage point through different places in the book. I was praying, and the angel appeared to me, and he's talking about Daniel. Okay, so the author is Daniel. His name means God is my judge. Whenever you see L on the end, that's God. Donnie means my judge. My judge is God, or God is my judge. Okay, the date. Daniel records events that start happening at the beginning of the exile. For chapter 1, he tells us when Nebuchadnezzar came up against Jerusalem and besieged it. So basically from 606, 605, we don't know exactly because of the calendar differences, was it 606 or was it 605? It was in that period of time. And then he records to us a whole bunch of different events and visions he had. And the last thing he tells us is about a vision he has in 536 B.C. Chapters 10 to 12 are one vision, his fourth vision. And he tells us the date. He tells us a lot of dates in the book. Not every chapter, but a number of them are dated specifically. Okay? So we know that he describes, here he is as a young man being taken captive.
70 years later, he's describing a vision. Maybe he's 14 or 15 here. He's 85 here when he has this last vision. You know, he's like 83 when he's in the lion's den. Chapter 6, when you look at the dates, you see this. He wasn't a little boy in the lion's den. He was an old man in the lion's den. Okay? Now, what I'm saying is, he describes the events and the visions that happened during this period of time. The question is, when did he write that, and when was this message given to the people of God? You see that? Daniel wasn't, he's unique in that he wasn't like the other prophets like Jeremiah who are out prophesying on a day-to-day basis. They're out delivering their message, and then somebody writes it down. But the message is going out at a point in time, like, you know, Jeremiah's prophesying 600, 605, then he's all the way up to the exile. So that his message was getting out then. Daniel's message is basically private to Daniel until he formally puts it all together and gives it to the people of God at a point in time. Does that make sense? So that when does he give it to them? That's the question. Well, he gives it to them sometime after 536. Sometime after the exile is done, they get this message. Do you see the importance of that? So when we're thinking about how to interpret a book, one of the things you want to think about is the original author and the author and the original audience of the book. This applies even to Jeremiah in one sense too. I mean, he's giving his message out, but his final written form, his canonical form, you think about when it was too. Though there's a little bit of a blend over there. It had application when he first said it, and then had application when he wrote it down and gave it to the church, to the people of God. Okay? Now, so we think about author, we think about date, and we think about this impacts. Now that's old stuff here. Pay no attention to the stuff on the board right now. I'm going to say a little more about how after we're done with the blessings of what it was a blessing to us, me and Patty and Maggie and John on Sunday, your kindness and how humbled we were by it. But and the number of cards that y'all gave us is just, we sat up Sunday night just reading the cards, and there were so many precious ones from the little kids. And anyway, one though was this picture on the front. I knew who had done it when I looked at it. It was clearly Thelma Wenzel's handiwork. And it said, Sotheby's Fine Art Reproductions. And, you know, it's this card. You open it up, and it is two pictures of my board when I drew the picture of Ezekiel's temple. Remember, I made the mistake of saying, somebody should take a picture of that. I don't want to lose it. So she had two pictures. One picture was and then the other one was a zoomed in of that amazing drawing. So I bring it, you can see it. Thankfully, I knew what it was because there was enough detail of scratching that I could tell. But I don't think anybody else would know what it was looking at it. But anyway, I don't know why I said that. I guess the board got me thinking about it. But what we're going to talk about now is the setting. And I want to think about the setting of the original audience, okay? The setting of the original audience, post-exilic, 535, 530 B.C., and the people of God kind of moving forward from there. God ordained that Daniel give this message to them to guide them forward. Think about their circumstances for a moment. These are the people. Now, and you've got two different groups of Israelites. You've got the group that's still over in Babylon, and then you've got a large group that's come back to the land and living in Israel, the land of Israel, right? What's their circumstances they're experiencing or going to be experiencing going forward? Well, one of the things is they come back to the land, they're expecting the glory to return. You know, they're hoping that David's going to reign over them again. A son of David's going to reign over them. They're going to be their own nation again. They're going to be great again. But what's their future really hold? They're still under Persian domination when they come back. They're under the Persians.
And they're under the Persians from 539 to like 333 or somewhere around there when Alexander comes in. And the Greeks take over. Then they're under the Greeks from 333, like 165. When you have a brief respite under the Maccabeans from like for, you know, 30, 40 years, I forget how many years it is. Anyway, a little brief time, and then you're under the Romans. So you have the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans rule over them. These are great world powers. They are under this kind of political tyranny. What are their circumstances? And you think about what are the issues in their lives that they're facing so that we can understand why God gives them Daniel, the book, okay? They're under political tyranny. At times, incredibly painful political tyranny, like under Antiochus Epiphanes. They are, I mean, they're being, they've been overcome, and they continue to be ruled by great military might. I mean, kind of awesome military power that they're subjugated by. First of all, the Babylonians who subjugate them, but now the Persians who beat the Babylonians, and the Greeks who destroy the Persian Empire in just basically 15 years or so. Alexander wipes out the Persian Empire. He didn't have airplanes. He didn't have, you know, big boats like we have now that can travel so fast as sailing boats. And then on the land, they basically wipe out the Persians. So political tyranny, military might, economic prosperity. They're seeing this first in the Persian people, in the Greek people. They're seeing intellectual achievement. I mean, they're ruled by the great nations of the world. You could add cultural pride. I mean, you just reflect on this a little bit. Think about, I mean, the Persians, the Babylonians were proud of who they were. They thought they had everything the best. Then the Persians felt that way, and certainly the Greeks did. They took cultural pride to a new level. I mean, Alexander thought everybody ought to learn Greek. They ought to learn about Plato and Aristotle and Socrates because everybody else is a bunch of idiots. It's what Alexander thought. And his goal was to Hellenize, which is another word saying to Greekize the world, right? So cultural pride. But then you also have things like moral depravity, religious pluralism, and spiritual, I could say darkness, but I would also add power. Real spiritual power. They're kind of awed by these circumstances. You think about what they live in. They go from being Israel, who is God's people set apart in His land, carried off into captivity where they're awed by the Babylonians, and Daniel experiences that, and we watch him experience this. But then when they come back, they're under now Persian armies marching through. Military power, Persian laws. They see the economic prosperity of those around them. It's easy for them to be envious of their captors. The intelligentsia looks down upon them. They're looked down upon culturally. You backward Jews, you see. And then look at the incredible wickedness that they're surrounded by, and religious pluralism, always lead to God, and then spiritual darkness and spiritual power. This is what they're in. Now, these are the kind of challenges they face. Now, what does Daniel live through? I would put before you that what Daniel basically does is goes in, and he and his friends live in this exact kind of environment. And that the first six chapters of Daniel, which are, when we look at the outline, are the historical narrative stories about Daniel,
are basically hero stories that tell you how you ought to live in this kind of malaise. If you live in this kind of environment, you can make it. Daniel and his friends did. And you make it the same way they made it. You see, in thinking about the audience helps you to understand and read the text. And I think when you read it, you see it's exactly what is being set before you. We're going to do this a lot quicker than we did a couple years ago when we went through Daniel, too. I forgot how many messages it was. We're going to do it. Plan is for three. Okay? You're going to have, you can remind me of that in a few weeks.
How many?
How many?
In Lamentations, how many?
Oh, that's true. I have a way of underestimating. But the plan is three. Subject to change. To be determined, right? But anyway, when you think about this, then you put yourself in Daniel chapter 1. Let's read the first few verses of Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. You got the military might and the tyranny. You've got the cultural and kind of religious pride. He takes the vessels of the temple, and this wicked king takes them and puts them in the temple of his God. How outrageous. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles. So Daniel was one of the royal family and the nobles. He was of noble birth. Then youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered them to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So Daniel and his friends are brought in to this situation. They're brought into Babylon, where they see incredible economic prosperity, military might, intellectual achievement. Oh, I meant to add another word in, technological advancement. I mean, all around them, they're looking at the ziggurats. There's a lot of thought that they had electrical lighting and stuff in Babylon because of the batteries that they think they found and stuff. So, I mean, it was an awesome place to go. Wow! And so, it had that kind of effect. So, they're taken there, and now they're being indoctrinated into the spiritual darkness and religious pluralism and intellectual pride of the Babylonians. And they're basically ordered to be in a three-year program, verse 5 says. At the end of a three-year training program, they'll enter into the service of the king. They'll be an advisor for the king. The king had the practice, as many in that day did, of taking the cream of the crop of whatever country they subjugated, take the intelligent young people, train them for service to the king so they'd have the best of the best of all the different lands. But of course, they got to be indoctrinated into the true, highest forms of knowledge, which are Babylonian at this time. Then later, no, they're the Persians. And no, later, it's the Greeks. Okay? So this is what they're living under. Now, when you understand that, then you step back from it and you say, okay, let's think about the content. That's the setting. Now let's think about the content of the book. This, I guess, would be point four. I was numbering these. Author, date, setting, content. The content of the book. And when you observe the book of Daniel, and you look at it, how God has given it, I mentioned earlier observing the dates, and I want us to do this for a second. What happens at chapter 1, verse 1, we're told, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. 1-1 is dated. So we got a date there. And that is 605 BC, or 606. Okay? That's when that happened. Now, you turn to chapter 2, verse 1. There's not a date, but we can... Well, yeah, I'm sorry, there is a date. There's not one in the next chapter. In chapter 2, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar... And this means, we were talking about the reign of Jehoiakim. This is from the perspective of Israel. The second reign of Nebuchadnezzar over Israel, this means 604, 603, while Daniel and his friends are still in training school. That's chapter 2, okay? Then chapter 3 is when, well, let me just talk. Remember, chapter 1 is the whole issue is they're put in training school, and they're supposed to eat the king's choice food and drink the king's wine. And they realize that as Hebrews, the question is, are they going to defile themselves by violating the dietary laws that they are bound to obey in that stage of God's plan of redemption? The law applies to them. And Daniel makes a decision, and his friends make a decision, they're not going to defile themselves with the king's choice food. And they came up with an alternative. Let us eat vegetables and drink water, and the rest of the guys can eat meat and drink wine, and then test us after a period of time and see if we're not doing better or doing well enough. Because the captain of the bodyguard is scared. If he doesn't take good care of these kids, he may get killed. Nebuchadnezzar, as we find out as we go through this, is not a real easygoing king. And so they don't defile themselves, and God supernaturally blesses them, and they, despite all expectations, are stronger and smarter than the others. By the way, let me say this. When I was years ago, we had one of the families that joined the church. The young lady was a vegetarian and a vegan and very much against eating animal meat and stuff. I mean, she was like 15 or 16, and she was just, you know, young, idealistic and everything. But she had just gotten saved recently, and I was talking with her, and we were talking, and she said, well, Daniel chapter 1 proves that vegetarianism is the way to live. And I was like, well, let's look at that together. And so I went back and looked at it with her, and what Daniel chapter 1 really tells you is that in spite of vegetarianism, God miraculously blessed his people supernaturally. The point is, it's a miracle that they were doing so well not eating meat and not eating the king's choice wine. That's the point. It's not an advertisement for being a vegan. I'm not saying that, you know, right now I'm trying to eat less meat myself. I overdo it, you know, in that area. And God's got me on a, hey, let's cut back and be moderation, you know. But there's no biblical basis for being a vegetarian after the flood. Not a biblical basis. You may decide that's something you want to do for a period of time. That's fine. But don't try to preach that as something that God teaches. He said in Genesis 9, after they come off the ark, all the animals are food for you now. Well, God said that. That settles it. Okay, so anyway. All right, sorry to get off on that. You've got to deal with the important things as we go along, too. Anyway, so there's that miracle, and the Lord blesses them. So they fasted, they pass the initial test. So when you experience political tyranny, pressure, cultural pressure to conform, spiritual oppression, what do? You stay faithful to God. This is how you live in that setting. You make your desire one ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. That's our ambition. So that's what happens chapter 1. Chapter 2, they're still in training school. They're just into they're halfway. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And his dream is troubling him, and he decides he's on to his wise men. He knows that they're kind of shysters, and that he decides, if you guys really, you claim to be able to be in contact with the gods, so if you're in contact with the gods, you know, I want you to interpret my dream, but I want you to interpret my dream without me telling you my dream. Without me telling you my dream. Because you should be able to figure it out anyway. And they're like, hey, nobody's ever asked this. No king's ever asked this of his wise man. And he says, if you don't do it, I'm going to kill all of you. And not only you guys, the guys in training school too. Daniel gets word about it, and he asks the king for time, and then he goes and prays, and God gives him the dream and the interpretation. And then he praises the Lord, who is the revealer of mysteries. He goes before the king, and he says, King, it's not because of me, but the Lord in heaven has revealed this to me. And he tells him his dream and the interpretation of the dream. And Nebuchadnezzar, we think, might be converted, but we know he's not. Shortly after this, he says, surely your God is the revealer of mysteries. He praises the God of Daniel, and he says, anybody says anything against him, may they be destroyed and their house made a rubbish heap. Don't speak against the God of Daniel. Well, anyway, so chapter 2, even in the face of, you know, uncertainty, what do you do? Trust God. Pray. The Lord's the one who's sovereign. That's what's happening here is the Lord, Because when you see all of this happen, when you're surrounded by this, and for us today, we see a lot of these things. We see religious pluralism, spiritual darkness, and moral depravity, and cultural pride, intellectual prejudice, achievement, but pride in that. All of these things, looking down on Christianity and telling us we don't know what we're talking about, we're idiots, right? What do? We focus on the fact that the God of heaven is the one that reigns. It's not unusual for God's people to be kind of trampled underfoot by society. Don't be alarmed. You see, he's telling this to people that are going to go through hundreds of years of it. From 535 all the way till Jesus, they're going through this, except for that little bit of time, and it wasn't that easy during the Maccabean days either. Okay? They're fighting for their lives the whole time. So, be faithful. That's chapter 2. Well, then we find out that Nebuchadnezzar wasn't saved at the end of chapter 2 because, remember, the vision was a four-part statue. Gold head, silver chest and arms, bronze thighs and waist, and then iron legs and toes made out of clay and iron. Remember? These are four kingdoms. First is you're the head of gold, old Nebuchadnezzar. Then the next, after you will come another kingdom, not as great. Then a third kingdom. Then finally a kingdom of iron that tears down and tramples everything under it. And then this little stone is taken out and throws against that. This little stone knocks, and when it hits the statue shatters. And in the same way, a rock made out of hand, not with hands, is going to be taken out. This little stone is going to destroy the kingdoms of the world. That stone is Christ. We know now. And the people of God were to say during this time, though the kingdoms of the world look so impressive, like a giant statue, and though we are these little tiny specks against that, don't let appearances deceive you. The Most High reigns. And remember what happens in chapter 3 then. Nebuchadnezzar says, well, you said, God said, the revealer of mysteries, who I was praising in chapter 2, said that it would be my kingdom will be for a little while, then a silver kingdom, then a bronze kingdom, then an iron kingdom. I'm going to make a statue, a giant statue. It's going to be all gold. This is where we know Nebuchadnezzar wasn't converted. He continues to demonstrate that throughout chapter 3 as well, doesn't he? He's saying, I don't care what God said, my kingdom's going to last forever. That's what he's saying with that gold statue. And he proves that he's really messed up because he wants everybody to worship the image he sets up. And I think it's interesting. Remember, Daniel's not there in chapter 3 because Nebuchadnezzar is kind of afraid of Daniel, and he's left him back in Babylon. He's gone down the plains of Shinar, but he did bring along Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they won't bow down, remember? And Nebuchadnezzar is enraged with them. If you don't bow down, I'm going to throw you in the furnace. And he tells them, what God can deliver you from my hand? Audacity of that man. So, but God protects Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They don't worship. Don't worship the false gods, no matter how impressive and overwhelming it is. Stay true to God. Worship Jesus Christ and Him only. Okay? Then chapter 4, finally we have Nebuchadnezzar. I think I titled my first message in chapter 4, The Most Unlikely Prophet, or The Most Unlikely Evangelist. Nebuchadnezzar apparently is converted. We have his story of his conversion in chapter 4. And remember how the Lord humbles him. He's so proud of himself, and he has that vision. And he thinks, this is Babylon the Great, which I have built by the might of my power and for the glory of my name. And at that moment, he hears a voice out of heaven, the kingdom is removed from you. And he basically, for 7 years, he lives like an animal. His hair becomes like matted like feathers. I mean, his hair's so nasty, he's not washed for 7 years. I mean, think about that. Some of you young people probably have to be reminded to bathe. You know, I had to be. When you're young, it's, why take a bath? Why waste time doing that? You're just going to get dirty again anyway, right? Well, actually, it's a good thing to do. So listen to mom and dad and take the baths. But if you didn't take one for 7 years, man, you would be nasty. Can you imagine? Your hair, and that's what Nebuchadnezzar, he was living like an animal. He was eating grass. He's down on all fours eating grass. This is the great king who has exalted himself. God puts him on his face, and then finally God grants him grace. He looks up to heaven and he gives praise to the Most High who lives and reigns forever. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. And he rules over all the realm of mankind and bestows the kingdom to whomever he wishes, even to the lowliest of men, Nebuchadnezzar says, because he now knows, I am the lowliest of men. And God did that. So you see that somebody like, I mean, the president of our country or the ruler of Russia or Iran or Syria or whoever who might exalt themselves and look great and think they're wonderful, all God has to do is pull his hand back and they're on the ground eating grass. Why would you be afraid of them? Be afraid of the one who holds them in his hand. Fear God and fear Him only. You don't have to worry about the people and the powers. That they're in the hand of the Most High. Gives them to whoever he wishes. Chapter 5, you have the opposite extreme. His grandson, Belshazzar, throws that feast and he mocks God to his face by drinking out of the holy vessels. And he's doing it with a Median army right outside the gates of Babylon. And that very night, he sees the handwriting on the wall, Mene, 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 Tekel, O Parson. You've been found, weighed in the balances and found wanting. The kingdom is taken from you. And that night, he dies. And God takes Babylon the Great and puts it on its face. And he puts Cyrus the Persian and Darius the Mede over Babylon. Then chapter 6, in the first few years of Darius, first 3 years of the Persian Medo-Persian rule, actually the first year. We don't have a date, but it looks like the first year because right away it's talking about the administration of the government and about Daniel and his faithfulness to God. Remember, they're told don't pray to anybody except the God to you, Darius. They should not pray to anybody except to you because, you know, you're God, you're a great ruler. So everybody should pray to you for a certain period of time. And Daniel continues to pray to the Most High God, and he does it as he always had, at his window facing Jerusalem. And the people see him, they accuse him, and if anybody does that, you're going to be thrown in the lion's den. He's thrown in the lion's den, and God delivers him. So the message is, be faithful to God. And what's interesting, though, now, is you don't have a date for chapter 3 or chapter 4. This looks like it's pretty closely tied to chapter 2. This is the vision of the statue with four types of metal. Nebuchadnezzar says, ha, all gold. Chapter 4, really we don't know when it is. We know that Nebuchadnezzar quits reigning. He dies in 562. And 605 to 562 is his reign over Israel, 43 years. Okay? We know that Belshazzar begins to reign as co-regent with his dad in 550 B.C. And that, now this, I'm sorry, but chapter 5 is 539 B.C. because that's when Babylon falls. Okay? You follow the chronology. And then chapter 6 is in 538 B.C. So the chronology goes from, and it goes in chronological order, right on down to 538. Then chapter 7, you have a breaking of the chronology. Chapter 7, verse 1 says this, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions. This goes back up to 550. I know that the way I write on this board, chapter 7 is, let me see if I can erase this. Here we go. I don't think we're going to need to take a picture of this one tonight. Chapter 7 is 550, the first year of Belshazzar, okay? Then you look, chapter 8's dated as well. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, probably about 548. Then chapter 9, in the first year of Darius, 538. And then chapters 10 to 12 is one vision. Yeah, these four visions, and you have the last vision, chapter 10, in the third year of Cyrus. Cyrus and Darius reign together. The Medes and Persians are together. So it's 2 years after this, 536. Can you see that? Make sense? The chronology? So what you have is the chapters run like this, and then they go back up here, and they fill in here. So the chronology's broken. Why is that? This is the kind of question we need to ask as we interpret the Bible. Why didn't he just go ahead and tell the vision? Why didn't he tell us about Belshazzar, these two visions here that happened before chapter 5? These should have come between chapter 4 and 5 if you're doing it chronologically. Right? Why not? Well, when God inspired Daniel to write it, he didn't want him to do it that way. It wasn't about the chronology. It was about dividing the book differently. This is the kind of question. Okay, that's the, you have to ask the right question, get the right answer. Apparently, the first six chapters are grouped together, and the last six chapters are grouped together because the last six chapters, these four visions, they are four visions. This is this part of the first half of the book, chapters 1 to 6, are historical narrative of Daniel's life. And we're looking at Daniel and his three friends. We're walking with them through their day-to-day, I mean, not constantly their day, but we walk through moments in their lives where they encounter incredible opposition and difficulty. I mean, we just talked about, we have Daniel in the lions in chapter 6. We have them threatened with death in chapter 2 and chapter 3. And then we have, the kings dealt with in chapter 4 and chapter 5. So, this historical narrative section, and then you have the second section, it we could call apocalyptic prophetic. Apocalyptic is a word which means revelation. It's actually the word, our English word apocalyptic comes from two Greek words, or actually from a Greek word, apokalupto, but from two Greek words, apa and kalupto, out from the cover, from under the cover. It means to be unveiled. So apocalyptic literature is that which unveils something. Okay? And really, these chapters are all apocalyptic. That is, they are prophetical passages filled with images and a powerful, figurative language that are to have an emotional impact on the reader. This is what prophetic literature and apocalyptic literature is about. It's about having you feel the impact. You feel the impact when you read a story too, but it's a different thing. I mean, when you think about this for a moment, you read these stories, you get caught up in them, right? I mean, you feel the pressure for the three guys when they're getting ready to get thrown in the fiery furnace. And when it's so hot that the people who carry them up die. Remember that? They're going to drop them in, they die. But the three guys are dancing in the fiery furnace with someone who looks like the Son of Man. And they come out, and the only thing that burned up when they were in the fire was the ropes they were bound with. This is what God does in delivering His people. This is what God is able to do whenever He wants to. Well, you're caught up in that, but when you go to chapter 7... the first vision is of four terrifying beasts. I mean, and the description is such that you're supposed to see the picture, And he tells you about these four beasts, and the final beast is this beast with iron teeth and iron claws, 10 heads, and it's got horns coming out of its head randomly almost. I mean, it's something that's just incredibly bestial and terrifying. It's a dreadful, terrifying beast. It tramples on all the other beasts. It smashes them down to the ground, and it's got this horn that's breathing out blasphemies, and this horn that comes off of this thing is attacking the saints of God, and then thrones are set up and the Son of Man comes. So you feel the weight of that, and when you read that, Daniel was just, before he sees the Son of Man, or actually after he sees the Son of Man, I think he's saying, I want to know about that, tell me about that beast and the horn. He's overwhelmed by it. In fact, when you read through those last six chapters, 7 to 12, you find things like Daniel saying, you know, I was completely overwrought by the vision, and I laid in my bed for days after he sees a vision. I mean, the impact of it was incredible. The force of these visions, when he saw it, it wasn't like, you know, watching a cartoon. He was caught up into what he saw. Now, what was he seeing? What was being unveiled for him? And why is it done this way? Half of the chapters, historical narrative, half of the chapters in apocalyptic literature. What's happening is we're looking at real life experience in these chapters on our level. What you and I could see if they had CNN, let's forget that, they had the Fox News channel back then, you could see this happening, right? You could hear a report on it. And so you see, look what happened over here. He set this golden statue up and all these people were worshiping, but these three guys didn't. And they were delivered from the fiery furnace. And film, you know, coming up. Well, you see that. What's this about here? What God is doing, he's unveiling. He's unveiling the spiritual powers that are at work unseen in these six chapters. He's taking you behind the scenes to look at the ugliness of the evil that is animating Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar and all of the wicked powers throughout history. So that you have, and you and I, and the Israelites when they first got it, and we today have a right understanding. In real life, the message is be faithful, God's on the throne, and everything's going to work out. He's got it under control. But understand what you're dealing with. It's not about Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, we really found that out here, didn't we? God pulls his hand back. He's dumber than a cow. And it really is true that God puts over the kingdoms the lowliest of men. I think when you really listen to these guys, sometimes you just think that, wow, isn't that true?